Coming up today, the FBI is struggling to come to terms with the £2 million worth of seized bitcoins it ended up with after shuttering Silk Road. Peter Higgs and his colleague have been awarded a shared Nobel Prize in Physics for their work on the Higgs boson discovery. And what do the numbers 11.21, 1 billion, 24 and 7 have in common? We're about to find out all that and more on this week's Wired UK podcast. This is the Wired Cut UK podcast, your weekly guide to the important and interesting, from science and tech to GCHQ and jellyfish-destroying robots. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired UK.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And I'm humming Metallica tunes. I went to see that new Metallica movie last night, the Through the Never. 3D IMAX, 1.5 hours of Metallica. Absolutely brilliant. Awesome use of cinematography.
Not my cup of tea, but
yeah,
I
not
imagine
mine either.
The impact was heavy.
Oh, it's good. I think it's probably the best example of what a concert film can be in the modern world.
Why? What were the highlights?
I'm going to write about it on Wired UK. You can look there. It's not on the running order.
I just
had to mention it. Well, we've got a lot coming up today, so let's leave the banter there and jump into the news. First, highlighted as news, is that some campaign groups, Liv, are taking the British government to court over surveillance.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Well, this is all after all of the revelations from whistleblower Edward Snowden about the extent of the US and UK government surveillance. And so the Open Rights Group, Big Brother Watch and English Pen, along with a German internet activist, are actually going to go to the European Court of Human Rights to take the UK government to court, to hold them to account.
Now, they're saying that that GCHQ was actually acting illegally by collecting so much data coming in and out of the UK, right?
Yes, exactly. You know, they could even read people's social media messages and emails. The things they're particularly focused on are two programmes. One's called Tempora, which allows the UK government to tap subprime ocean cables that carry all of the UK and pretty much all of Europe's traffic around the world. And the second one is PRISM, which is a US government programme, but it allows the US government to access data of British citizens who use things like Google, Facebook and Microsoft.
Now, I read that they're collecting something like 20-odd petabytes of data a day on UK citizens.
It's incredible. That is the equivalent, according to the campaigners, of all of the information contained in the British Library being scanned 192 times in every 24 hours.
That doesn't actually mean anything to me, to be honest, because I don't actually know how much data that is. Is it all pictures and material? But it's like, you know, a terabyte, there's 1,024 terabytes in a petabyte.
Yeah.
And you have maybe a couple of terabytes in your entire computer.
Yeah.
And we're talking daily.
Just think the British Library has a copy of every single book ever printed in the UK. Every ISBN number, it takes a copy. So anyway, it's a lot of information. And this campaign was set up to raise money to cover the legal costs. Now, the reason they're going to the European Court of Human Rights is because they're actually questioning the structure of British law rather than a wrong implementation of the law. So they need to go above the British courts in order to question the laws that have been enshrined within British law. And so the particular issue that they find the British law is at odds with is Article 8 of the Convention of Human Rights, which is the right to respect for one's private and family life, his home and his correspondence. And I guess in this case, his correspondence, or his or her, is the critical point. And the kind of aim is to actually reform the British law.
I'm no legal expert. Is this realistic? I mean, how would this even happen as a process?
Well, there has been a precedent. I spoke to one of the solicitors involved in the case, a guy called Daniel Carey, about the process. And he said there's been a precedent where a prisoner questioned the fact that all of his communications were being intercepted when he was in prison. And he took it to the European Court of Human Rights because the other course of action to pursue within the UK would be a tribunal that deals with a law called REPA, which is the Regulation of Investigatory Powers Act. Now, the problem was that he was questioning the methodology of this law or how people were implementing this law. And so he needed to go above it in order to in order to do anything about it.
I mean, this surely goes deeper even than UK law. I mean, if one of the complaints here is against PRISM, which is a US program, then surely lobbying to change sort of British law that would affect international relationships and things with the US and how that relates to international law and policy, like, that's not just your standard overturning of a law. I mean, that is a complete rethink of international politics.
It really is. I think the focus on this is on the UK stuff at the moment, but it will have wider implications if it is deemed to be a good case, and we will have to wait to see to find out if the European Court of Human Rights deems it to be so, then it will have implications for many other governments. But yes, the hope is that they'll be able to change the law, and ideally what these campaign groups are looking for is for there to be stricter rules about warrants for whose information can you access, and secondly making judges issue warrants rather than ministers. At the moment, a minister can order that they look into someone's communications, whereas in the US even they have stricter laws that mean that judges have to do so.
They have to get a warrant in order to be able to do it,
yeah,
as opposed to a minister who has no legal knowledge whatsoever.
Exactly. So far they've just filed a court document with the court, 68 pages, 1,500 supplementary pages. Now at the moment the European Court of Human Rights has to digest that information and then communicate the complaint to the government. The government will then have some time to respond, and then there'll be an oral hearing next year. And so if successful, the European Court of Human Rights would declare that REPA and the activities of GCHQ have actually breached the right to privacy, and the UK government would then need to come up with some legislative reforms.
Now, I'm always slightly nervous when things have to get communicated, things of a highly technical nature have to get communicated to the government by an interested party, because it's through bad communication that we got some of the laws surrounding copyright, piracy and DRM that led to some pretty disastrous consequences for the entire industries involved.
Yeah.
Not saying that will happen here, but I find it to be a troublesome process.
It is, but you have to remember that laws have to be kind of outside of technology. They have to apply across technology and then be interpreted for technology and updated as new technologies emerge. And I think in this case, we've got some pretty switched on stakeholders who will be keen to be involved in the reform.
Sticking on the topic of law now, we've picked up our Pritt stick, we've put a delicate sheen on the back of law, and we've stuck it to this podcast, Liat, because we're going to talk about the FBI, which has got £2 million worth of seized bitcoins thanks to shutting down Silk Road, and it has no idea what the hell to do with them, does it?
Yeah, there's not really a precedent for this kind of thing.
It's not. What do you do with such a huge stash of virtual currency?
Well, our colleagues over at Wired US actually did a bit of a rundown of what they could do. So at the moment, they've actually got 26,000 bitcoins worth $3.6 million, which amounts to about £2 million, and a separate wallet owned by Dead Pirate Roberts, who was the administrator, of 600,000, which they have not been able to actually crack. So that's a further 80 million that they cannot attain. What can they do with this measly 3.6 million by contrast? Well, the most likely solution is to auction it off, they concluded. Simply treat it as an asset rather than a currency, and put it up for a public auction as you would, a drug dealer's car or some such item.
Let's just recap on Silk Road. This was sort of the kind of nefarious underground black market eBay-like system where drugs and prostitution and all sorts of things were traded. And I think, I don't know, a recent figure, but it's like 5 or 10% of all bitcoins traded, I think, were traded through Silk Road, was a recent figure.
I think it was even more than that.
I think it's quite a bit more than that.
20%.
They had the rundown was ridiculous of kind of bitcoins in circulation today. Yeah, so it's I think it was more than 50%.
And it represents a great deal of real value as well. I mean, for example, if I went into a free-to-play game and it said buy some currency, and I spent £200 worth of virtual currency to buy, I don't know, donuts in Simpsons Tapped Out my iPad, and then the very next day EA say close the game down, I'd be like, what the hell, I just spent 200 things on in-game currency, you can have it back please. I think there's going to be people who want this back who are not going to be very happy that this is going to be auctioned off.
Well, there will be people who've put money in to buy drugs.
Yeah, this isn't money that they're taking from EA gamers.
This is
money from criminals.
It's money. Okay, fine.
You're playing devil's advocate.
I was trying as hard as possible.
I think you have to see it as like the people who are going to buy drugs off a street dealer, the cash that you found in his apartment, that's you're unlikely to go and ask for that back.
Yeah, that's exactly what would happen with any other seizure. It's just that this has never happened before. They've never seized an intangible asset.
That's fine. Or, I've come to a roadblock in my own argument. I can't go any further with that. That's fine. So, I mean, what do we expect to see here? I mean, really, how soon is this going to happen? Is this awful news for Bitcoin, do you think, as well?
No. Well, I spoke to a few people who say absolutely not. One of them happens to be a lawyer of the Bitcoin Foundation, so he would say that. But he pointed out that, obviously, this is actually proven that there are plenty of other uses other than these nefarious deeds, because otherwise there would, you know, there'd be a complete crash. There'd be of no value now, whereas the value actually bounced back incredibly quickly. It dropped just after the shutdown and went down to pre-shutdown levels within days. So it has demonstrated that it has the strength to come back from this and that there is a demand and a need for it. And I don't know, possibly it gives the government... it puts it in a position where they have to define it and they have to debate it more openly. But it will take a few years. You know, the Bitcoins, if they do get auctioned off, it will take a few years, you know, once the case has been closed and Dead Pirate Roberts is done away with, whatever happens to him.
And they'll sit on it, waiting for it to appreciate, and
yeah,
then they can sell it at a
worth
huge
billions
profit
instead. But I wonder if they'll crack his wallet. They need to sort that out.
Good use of the word crack there. I have a friend who's a jellyfish. He's pretty annoyed. Been shredded by a robot from Korea recently. This was a fab story about some Korean researchers who've developed a pretty terrifying machine that hunts down and kills jellyfish by effectively blending them in the sea.
Yeah, will it blend? Yes, they do. They're very easy to blend, jellyfish.
And delicious.
They're very cross about it. What's this all about?
Yeah, well, jellyfish populations are booming, partly because of warming seas and partly because of overfishing. And because there's so many of them, they can interfere with a number of different things. They can actually affect fish populations, make them decrease even further because they're competing for food. But they can also get stuck in the cooling systems of power plants, and they get stuck in ships.
So even though it's our fault because we're overfishing and rising temperatures, the solution is to slaughter them.
Yes.
Harsh. Yes.
Basically.
Correct.
If you breed, then stop breeding.
Yeah. Like the rabbits that we release in Australia.
Yeah.
Or the badger culls.
Oh, God.
There's one Japanese nuclear plant that actually has to remove 150 tons of jellies from its pipes every day.
Oh, when you put it like that, it sounds kind of sweet, doesn't it?
I kind of get it.
Yeah,
poor jellies.
Well, these are causing serious blockages. And similarly, jellyfish were actually responsible for shutting down one of the US's new battleships earlier this year.
That could be a new weapon of warfare.
And the problem is, yeah, exactly, release the jellies. But even if you kill them with other techniques, like you can electrocute them or you can poison them, their bodies can still be sucked into cooling systems. So they have to be killed with autonomous shredding robots.
I see this story's coming full circle now.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen these numbers, actually, before we started talking about them. I didn't realise it was quite that volume. But now looking at the notes, it says that one of these machines can destroy a jellyfish to the extent that they can get rid of almost a ton of jellyfish an hour.
Yeah. It's amazing.
That's awful.
Which means they've obviously already tested this and they've exterminated
There's videos.
A few tons.
How is this not some sort of weird movie?
It should be. The way they work is these autonomous machines floating around in the water, they have nets. They can use GPS to locate where the jellies are and cameras, and then they can sling a net around a big group of jellies and then draw the net in, sucking the jellies into their propeller. I think this is awesome, but a bit evil. But you know, it's just like a horror movie of being pulled, like James Bond perhaps might be, towards a propeller to be chopped up.
It's kind of like a real deep sea version of what happens at the sort of beyond the event horizon of a black hole.
Yeah, pretty much.
There's no escape.
There isn't.
Admittedly, there's no time dilation and, you know, relativistic consequences with the jellyfish, but it's similarly destructive.
And interestingly, you say there's no escape, but there is an interesting evolutionary escape mechanism for the jellies, and it's something that's been flagged up by Deep Sea News, which wrote an article explaining why this is such a terrible idea. So I'll come to that reason at the end, but there's a few reasons before that. First of all, the dead jelly, even if it's shredded, can sink to the floor, smother things on its on the seafloor, and also make its way onto the beach in vast quantities. It's not going anywhere. It's just being shredded into a, you know, slightly less cloggy format. Secondly, it actually still could clog power plants because even the jelly material, when it's kind of grouped together, even if it's been chopped up, can still be a really challenging material to work with. And some jellyfish are even too sturdy to be chopped up by these sorts of propellers. Apparently, there's a jellyfish called the Nomura, which might clog the propeller, rendering these robot chopping machines
and they can
redundant.
still sting you.
Yeah, well, that's you're separating off these little legs that have the stinging mechanism, and these little legs can then travel very, very, you know, through very small holes, so they won't be, you know, people won't be protected from any kind of nets or anything. But finally, and perhaps most importantly, cutting the jellies open releases the sperm and the eggs of the jellyfish into the water and can cause them all to fertilise at the same time, creating a vast number of baby jellies.
Now that is a horror
movie.
Which
will go on to avenge their parents.
And that's the tagline.
Is that like when you crush a wasp and about 50 of his mates turn up?
Basically, yes.
Now, I don't know. I mean, I can't really feel too sorry for the jellyfish. But on the other hand, it does make me think that if we're sort of destroying 900 kilograms of jellyfish an hour, what are we doing with the remains?
Yep.
Now, I Googled this, actually, as you were giving the explanation, and apparently a jellyfish can actually be used in things like creating antibiotics. They can also be used as a food additive, which I find bizarre. And some cosmetics, apparently, use bits of jellyfish.
So we just need a scooper. With the autonomous robot needs an extra
I just want to
appendage.
Find a way. If we're destroying all these jellyfish, there's got to be a practical use for them. I mean,
scoop
could we use them as some sort of like weird polyfiller? I mean, if they're that good at clogging, can we use that property to fix buildings or something? But certainly we could be using it in cosmetics, apparently.
I think something to suggest to the Korean Institute of Science and Technology.
Poor jellyfish. So, what's next in this smoke detector world, Leanne? That was a pun.
See what you did there? Yes. It's actually about a company called Nest, people. Nest Labs, which made the learning thermostat, has brought us Nest Protect, which is launching in the UK, US and Canada at the end of this year. This nifty device is a smoke and carbon monoxide detector. And if you're familiar with them, it's no ordinary device. It's pretty sweet, actually, and it links up to your smartphone. It will send you alerts when if anything's detected. It will have a button that goes straight through to the emergency services, things like that. So I want one. It has a photoelectric sensor which detects the smoke. Then there's the carbon monoxide detector and a speaker. It even speaks to you, Nate. It tells you when there's a fire. Because I thought this was quite interesting and terrifying. Children apparently don't wake up and hear when an alarm is sounding.
So this alarm screams, get out of bed, your house is on fire.
In a female voice, actually, it's quite soothing, apparently. No, I don't know if it's soothing, but it's a female tone. It's not angry Nate voice.
Good Lord.
So I think the idea of this company is to make, you know, everyday boring stuff desirable, cool, less annoying.
So this is coming out in the UK. It's cost £109. I think this is pretty exciting. I mean, it's a weird one in a way because a thermostat, if it's doing its job properly and your house isn't on fire, then you'll never notice it. So it's a very weird product to get excited about.
Yes, but have you ever had one beeping at you when it's run out of battery?
No.
Oh. Have you not? They don't stop until you take them down.
I once got driven mad by a smoke alarm that was running out of battery, and it would periodically beep in a really irritating way. But just when you thought it had stopped and just when you're about to, you know, fall off to sleep, it would beep again.
Yeah.
And then you'd remove
completely
the battery
sporadic.
And it would still beep. It's like that episode of Friends.
It is
Phoebe's
exactly that episode of Friends. It doesn't stop even when you take the battery out, even when you bash it. We've got some remains in our house right now, actually. So this one instead, it glows a pleasant green when all is well and yellow when all is not well. And you need to look at your battery. And then obviously it will alert you if things get really tough.
Great. This is actually... Nest is run by Tony Fadell. He made the iPod with Steve Jobs.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, as you would expect, design is pretty sweet. I mean, to me, it still looks a bit like a fire detector, smoke detector, but, you know, nice lines, nice glowing lights.
Yeah, some smoking hot tech. Quick update to a story that we talked about the other week, possibly even on last week's podcast, where I got all hot and excited about the idea of Half-Life 3 finally coming out after a decade. We wrote that there was a trademark registration which at the time there seemed to be, from Valve, registering Half-Life 3 as a trademark. Well, it looks like Valve may not have been behind such a trademark, because the application has now been removed from the database. And in a statement, Kristen Krolzik, who's a representative for the Office of, love this name, Office for Harmonization in the Internal Market, where the mark was applied for, said the filing, quote, has been deleted from the database as it is in status deemed not filed due to a lack of applicant, mark representation, list of goods and services, or payment.
How gutting was that?
It's a real shame. One of the commenters on our story actually said, couldn't they just use Half-Life as a trademark? Yes, bit of a shame that. So, boo, maybe no Half-Life 3 after all in the next 5 years. It's time to roll into an ad break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the Higgs boson, and specifically, people who first theorised that it existed. Oh, hello there. Do you want a free audiobook? Of course you do. We say this every week, and every week some of you do this. Audible.co.uk is still offering you, our delightful listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast, a audiobook for no charge from a catalogue of 80,000 for being a listener to this show. A one-month free trial still costs no pounds, no pence, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. So if you go now to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up, and a few clicks of that little mouse or that trackpad and download a book for free, you'll be supporting our show, which gives us a big fat grin every week, and you get to enjoy a book and perhaps the rest of the audible.co.uk service. Very little not to like. Head to audible.co.uk/wired. Welcome back. It's time to put on our physics trousers as we say thank you, science. Liv, we're thanking science this week for the Higgs boson, sort of.
Well, we are. We're actually thanking Peter Higgs and his colleague François Engler from Belgium, who have been awarded a shared Nobel Prize in physics for their work on the Higgs boson.
It's taken a while to get to this point. They theorised this in a rather elegant mathematical formula, which if you haven't seen, it's well worth looking at on the web, of the Higgs in the 60s. And it took until the LHC experiment last year to actually prove it existed.
Yeah, and it's really great when someone like Peter Higgs has actually seen through an experiment from the theory right the way through to a discovery, which is quite rare in science, I think.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And certainly for something like this to be proved in a lifetime. I mean, it's one of the interesting things actually about relativity is that every few years it seems to get proved to a higher and higher degree of accuracy, and quite bizarre.
And he was on holiday actually at the time, and he apparently didn't take a mobile phone, so he couldn't be disturbed by any sort of announcements about the Nobel Prize, as you do. But you recently met with Professor Brian Cox, as we heard in one of our previous podcasts, and he had an interesting idea about who perhaps the unsung heroes of the Higgs.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. So, I mean, obviously, Peter Higgs and colleagues deserve this, because if it wasn't for their sort of creative thinking back in the 60s, we wouldn't be in this position. We wouldn't have this answer to physics that a lot of people were seeking. But one of the things that Brian was saying, this was after our interview had concluded, was that there's a person called Lynn Evans, who certainly is a strong candidate for taking the physics prize, possibly even instead of Higgs. I mean, obviously, Cox didn't say he should get this instead of Peter Higgs, but he suggested it was a very good candidate, and there's a really good reason why. Lynn Evans was the project manager on the LHC and basically spent 20 years on the project. He joined in 1993 and saw it right the way through. So from initial idea formation and planning to developing all the teams, technology, budget, everything, the whole entire process to build this giant machine.
He absolutely should get one, but I reckon he's got to wait a couple decades.
Well, he may well, but I don't know. But it's amazing. I mean, there was an article in the pretty well-regarded science journal Nature that named him Newsmaker of the Year in 2008 for his work on the LHC. So, you know, he's not been an invisible person in the media, but, a lot of his work that helped make all this possible. It was just a really interesting observation that, you know, a lot of Nobel Prizes do go to the people associated with discoveries and such, but not necessarily to the people who sort of facilitated confirmation and things like that. So it was just kind of interesting that conversation was a few days ago. This came out today. I thought it was worth mentioning Lynn Evans. There's actually a really interesting article that I found. I was doing some background research on this on Nature. If you search Lynn Evans, that's L-Y-N Evans, on for on Nature. There's an article from 2008, I believe, quite a big feature about the initial planning of the LHC. It's some really interesting background about it. Our next topic, gaming the system. This week we had an article called Grand Theft Auto 5 by the numbers, which apparently was quite timely because Grand Theft Auto 5 has officially broken 7 Guinness World Records since its release on the 17th of September, according to Wired.co.uk this afternoon. So this is a game that shifted 11.21 million units on the first day of its release.
Wowie, we were.
That is amazing. It generated 511 million pounds in revenue, and on the 20th of September, 3 days later, it broke the $1 billion mark, which is just an absolutely incredible achievement. Now, Craig Glenday at the Guinness World Record Office, he's the editor-in-chief over there, said that this was a sign that gaming is no longer a niche and that GTA totally deserves to be recognised as an icon of modern British culture, because Rockstar North is based in Scotland and made the game. And we're thrilled to be able to feature this game in the record books.
It was not only the fastest game to gross the billion dollars, which you mentioned, but it was also the highest revenue generated by an entertainment product in 24 hours. An entertainment product, as in any film, any game, anywhere.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, the games industry, revenue-wise, generates more money than Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, this is the thing. I mean, it should, in a way, come as no surprise. Games often cost as much as a film to make. I mean, Grand Theft Auto, one of the other numbers that we had in our figure is that the total production, marketing, everything over the five-year period that it was in development cost $250 million when you add everything together.
I was going to say, it's the most expensive game.
It's also the most expensive game
paid off.
Ever made. But the fact is, it does make more money, and the game costs £60 a pop when you buy it, whereas a movie costs, you know, probably only about £50 a pop, based on some prices I've seen on cinema websites recently. We just thought it was worth noting because it is, you know, it is a game of British origin, and a lot of games like this do tend to come from North America, and it was it's nice to see so many records broken and so many nice words to be said about the British games industry, I think.
The Scottish.
Right, let's ride the Technosaurus. Liat, let me turn my head, my balls of eye in your direction.
Wow.
So you were you were in Rome recently. They see you roaming. But they're not hating, because you've been talking about Maker Faire, which had some amazing innovations. We wanted to touch on
It was so much fun.
Or three. So go on.
It was ridiculous.
Thrill me.
There were probably a couple hundred makers there showing their wares from all over Europe. And it was pretty incredible. You need more time. There is not enough time in the world for all these amazing
people. Hang about. Summary. What is Maker Faire?
It's where all the makers come together and demonstrate. It coincided with a launch from Intel for their kind of Raspberry Pi competitor.
Clone.
And a lot of the stuff we saw was based in kind of Arduino, using Arduino tools. However, there were people who were, you know, knitting stuff, sewing, laser cutting.
It's a giant high-tech
kind of lo-fi stuff as well.
Yeah.
There was kind of, you know, both. It was mainly high-tech.
So tell me about the Murmurs.
M-U-R-S. Yeah.
A talking, tweeting seat designed to make your office fun.
Yeah, I really think we should get some. Sadly, they're in the prototype stage at the moment. These amazing, cuddly, soft seats, they tweet when they get bored, they giggle when you tickle their ears, they groan when you sit on them, and they make nice dizzy noises when you turn them upside down.
It does sound like the world's geekiest whoopee cushion.
They're a bit bigger than that.
Yeah, it's a seat. Or, okay, given you're only like a few inches off the floor, but it's still a seat.
So what, you sit down and it's sort of a heavy object has landed on my
unexpected
cushion.
Item it in the sitting area.
No, it makes a really nice, like, it's really
don't
pleased
be so cheeky
by your bum being there. It makes kind of pleasurable groaning noises.
To be honest, I have always wondered what it would be like to live in a world where every time I sit down, a machine compliments me on my ass.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt.
I love that we live in the world.
That's why I enjoyed it so much. But you know, there's grumpy ones, there's happy ones, there's moody ones, there's scared ones. They have different personalities, so it's like a kind of fully fledged concept, and they, if you leave them alone for a while, they start they talk to each other because they've got Wi-Fi antennas, and they then start yawning, snoring, and dreaming, and you can hear their dreams. It's really quite soothing.
I like the idea of being in a bar, one of these is empty, and you just hear from the distance, "Come over here." Okay. I'm empty.
Well, sadly, they talk in murmur language, so you can't really understand what they're saying, but you can tell from their like suggestive tones. So anyway, this is actually a project from the University of Tampere's, I'm not going to say it right, Games Research Lab in Finland. They want to capitalise on the hybridisation of toys and gaming, something we've seen in the Skylanders franchise, but also working on solutions for promoting healthy and productive workspaces through play, which is where this comes in. It's not, you know, just to make us laugh, guys. It's to make us work harder. Because apparently it's proven that these kind of fun, playful situations correlate with social bonding and better productivity in the workspace.
I think we should experiment. We're moving at offices in a few weeks. I think we should experiment getting one of these in, getting an intern to sit in it, and see if a tweeting, yawning, burping seat encourages productivity.
I think that's a great plan.
I know. I wonder if it might do the opposite, but
all right.
For the first few days.
That's the smart posterior support system. What other highlights are there?
Well, there was a couple UK ones that stood out. There was the kitchen, which basically kind of wants to pick up from the DIY bio movement and meld it with art and design. They're making kits that you can take home and use everyday items in your kitchen to create new medium that you could sculpt with. Stuff like delicious looking chicken bones in vinegar, which kind of all the calcium is drained from them in this process if you leave it for a few days, and they get nice and bendy.
Hang on, so it's a box and you put old chicken bones in it.
Well,
it breaks them down.
You know, they tell you how to do stuff. I know it's not really very high tech, you know.
It's not that. It's just, it's beginning to sound like Mr. Fusion from Back to the Future. Just chucking a load of old garbage and it sort of produces power.
It's so much fun. Well, they're bendy chicken bones. They're not going to change the world. The sheep's heart in a box of detergent was my favourite because it freaked everyone out when they found out what it was. And it becomes this kind of weird, sticky, cotton, wool-type, fluffy stuff. And you're actually draining it of its cells.
So pretty good if you've mutilated any sheep recently and haven't found a use for its heart
yet.
You can
buy them in the supermarket, probably.
Okay.
Maybe a farmer's market.
I'm curious about Music Inc. as well.
I really like these guys. It's quite a simple use of bare conductive carbon paint, where they basically use they've developed this kit which can be used in schools to teach kids music and pitch and all kinds of other stuff about music. They can draw the instruments as a little trumpet, keyboard, and hook them up to a controller with electrodes, and then you can play them, which I found possibly more thrilling than the kids did there.
Tremendous.
Really fun.
Some tremendous stuff. And I really enjoyed reading these. I mean, you spent quite a few days out there, I think, and got to see a great number of the projects that were on show.
Yeah.
So for anyone curious, if you search Maker Faire, that's M-A-K-E-R Faire, F-A-I-R-E, on wired.co.uk, you'll find all of Liat's stories, some brilliant pictures in there as well. Highly recommended. Right, it's time to move into some feedback. We've got a few bits come in. We're going to start off with an interesting one about a conspiracy theory surrounding BlackBerry. Now, this comes in from Graham Smith, who says, "Hi all, wanted to drop you all a mail concerning the recent lawsuit against BlackBerry stating they misled consumers with false promises around OS X." Now, I'm going to interject here, Nate, that is. This is a class action lawsuit that's been filed against BlackBerry only of the last couple of days by a shareholder who claimed that the company misled investors about its future, the company's future, including how the BlackBerry 10 smartphone line would fare against competitors. Obviously, BlackBerry now up for sale and a lot of bother. Share price plummeted. Anyway, Graham continues, "I think this is business bullshit scaring away other companies from putting in a bid to beat the consortium. This wholesale stinks. I firmly believe there's a lot more to this than we're being told, and we may never find out. But if, say, Samsung or Microsoft came in with a counteroffer, then they would be given access to the accounts, wouldn't they? And I seriously believe this would tell a different story. I don't believe BlackBerry have lost the huge amounts they claim. I know you love a good conspiracy theory, Nate." God, I do. "So what are your thoughts? Keep up the great work. Love the podcast." He also adds a postscript that says that he's a BlackBerry fanboy and has been for quite a few years. So obviously a fan disgruntled by the whole thing. I think, to be honest, as much as I do like a conspiracy, I think everything that's going on with BlackBerry is nothing more than a bit of bad luck, some poor management, a slow response time to the smartphone market, and putting their efforts in the wrong effort pots when they should have been focusing elsewhere. I don't actually think there's a great deal of I don't think there's anything nefarious about this. I think it's just a company that hasn't done very well in a highly competitive marketplace,
yeah.
To be perfectly honest. What do you think, Liv?
I think you're right. I don't think that's what Graham wants to hear, though.
I don't, and I'm sorry, Graham.
I want Graham to be right, though.
I would. I mean, I like BlackBerry, and BlackBerry's done a lot of innovations. They've got a lot of patents, but the problem is that they haven't been competitive enough. You know, they stuck to old devices. They didn't move quickly enough. And then once they did, i.e. with the Z10, the touchscreen BlackBerry, it was just too little, too late. Even though the software was quite nice, people had just moved on. The adoption rate was too low. So I don't think we'll hear much different, to be perfectly honest.
We have also had an email from Christian Harris, who says, "Hello, Nate, Liv, Liat, and everyone else on the podcast."
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. I feel like there should be other people in here. I recently upgraded my iPhone 4S to have iOS 7 on it and wrote a review on my blog about it. Something I haven't seen posted in many places is the differences between iOS 7 on an iPhone 4S and an iPhone 5S, as both of them have very different aspect ratio screens. Do you reckon iOS 7 for iPhone 4 and 4S is just a scaled down or cropped version of the one on iPhone 5S and 5C? Or could Apple have made two different designs entirely to suit the two different size screens? Would love to know what you guys think.
Well, the answer is yes, it is a cropped version. The extended screen is basically there to accommodate an additional line of apps on the home screen, and goes from being not quite a widescreen screen to being a true 16:9 screen. The actual underlying code is identical. It's the same. There's some slight optimizations in there for the different processors and to manage different types of CPUs and graphics chips and stuff. But basically, the code is the same. The real difference is actually under the hood of iOS 7 on the 5S, because it's a 64-bit chip and the code runs in 64 bits as opposed to just 32. But that's not really probably what you're asking.
I think that sounds like you've answered it.
Yeah.
Christian also wanted to be a freelance writer, and I'd suggest sending pictures at wired.co.uk.
Yeah, P-I-T-C-H-E-S at wired.co.uk. It's really good to basically flatter Liv and I's egos, because we do all the sort of commissioning for Wired. And we're hard asses, aren't we, Liv?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, Mark Wrigley on the Facebooks asks, how about a little more on breakthroughs in nuclear fusion? Now, this is something, Liat, you were asking questions like what everyone here talked about on the podcast.
I was.
He
wants challenging
to
us.
Nuclear fusion. Don't know. There's not been a lot of nuclear fusion in the works in the news recently. We do a fair bit on cold fusion from a, you know, sceptical but fair standpoint, because there's some interesting innovations going on. Well, apparently going on with, what's his name? Andrea Rossi, the Italian sort of cold fusion physicist. So we occasionally do these stories whenever this comes up, and they always do pretty well, because we attack them in a skeptical but balanced and not optimistic, but, you know, through the eyes of someone who's like, maybe this could be good sort of way.
And we will attack them more for Mark.
Yeah.
But Paul Mellish is a bit more on trend with his topic, which was curved phone displays, ergonomic revolution or dodgy display decision.
Makes sense. Not a massive innovation. Curved screens make more sense when they're bigger. A curved screen on a phone doesn't hugely benefit people unless you've got a very specific vision problem, perhaps, or you have difficulty with reflecting light. I think LG has just announced a curved screen. I think Samsung is about to. I don't know if that's come out yet, but curved screen. And it's just it's kind of like that both of those companies are doing with their TVs. So I don't think they are ergonomic revolutions, but nor do I think they're dodgy. I think it's just kind of like a lot of things Samsung does. It's an experiment. Now, Peter Lucas, also on Le Facebooks, says, do you this is an interesting one.
It's really covered the bases here.
Yeah, he's got quite a few. Do you feel as if tech development is stifled of late? Yes, I do, to a certain extent. I think we're in kind of a weird gigahertz race in the phone wars, where it's just about fast and bigger rather than efficient and useful. He continues, where are the advances we as consumers have been promised time and time again? Well, I don't know. They come out in drips. A lot of the real advancements, I think, actually go on under the hood and people don't notice things. But there's a reason why, for example, on the iPhone side, the 5S only has a 1 and a bit gigahertz processor and only has 1 gig of RAM, and yet is arguably faster in terms of performance than an 8-core Samsung S4.
I feel as though his questions are a bit bigger scale than that, though. I think he's looking at like innovation in general. Like we've had...
Where's my jetpack?
Yeah, literally. Yeah. I mean, the next question is like, what's the real deal with things like HARP or chemtrails?
Well, HARP's a fascinating topic.
Speak more about it, please. Okay.
Oh, some great conspiracy theories around HARP. You should definitely check that out. Why are we still so reliant on fossil fuel when we're obviously far more advanced? Well, because we've got entire industries and economic arrangements that depend on the sale and trade of fossil fuels, not to mention the billions of cars on the planet that also rely on them. It's kind of difficult to just retrofit those with hydrogen fuel cells, although some people are trying and should, because hydrogen fuel cells are brilliant and their exhaust is water and they're fantastically efficient things, but also very expensive and very difficult to fuel on the go.
He does actually flag this up with, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I would just like some honest answers as a parent and home-owning tech-enjoying person.
Well, I would say, Peter, there is a lot of innovation to be had. The problem is that once it becomes a consumer offering, it also has to have mass appeal. And a lot of the really high-end stuff tends to be in the military applications. Then it comes down through really high-end tech that's ludicrously expensive. And only then does it trickle down into the sort of mainstream. And by that point, we've been at least aware of the tech for a few years. And it doesn't feel like it's that revolutionary. The real challenge is taking yesterday's expensive tech and making it affordable to the average guy in the street. And it's just not as exciting, but it's actually pretty brilliant.
We also had an interesting feature that might be worth checking out about a theory as to why we haven't had such leaps of innovation as we did in throughout the 60s, 70s. And it suggested that because we've had so much dystopian science fiction, we've had this negative outlook. The recent science fiction has been about, you know, apocalyptic disasters as opposed to going to space, jetpacks, etc., that the latest wave of innovators haven't been as inspired as they could be.
I liken it to tower defense games, where you'll always lose if all you do is plant guns to kill enemies. You have to plant defenses first and then strategically shoot your enemies.
Yeah,
that's what we need to do with tech.
I think our expectations were also raised so high that all the amazing things we hear about today were just like, meh. Yeah. We were told about this like in the 60s and the Jetsons told us this. Why?
Well,
thanks
for that. Your expectations that this is the end of the show should be very high, because it is. But it's not to go without saying, or not to go without... I don't know, you know where I'm going with this. Basically, our new issue, our November issue of Wired Magazine, is still on shelves because it's only just come out. 100 hottest startup features in there, and it's doing, as the US would say, gangbusters, I think. Huge amounts of interest in this, in the 100 most interesting startups across the continent. Vital reading, much of which was written by Liv.
Not much. I wrote the London section,
that's
and 10%. It's amazing.
That's 10%. if I had 10% of £1 million, I'd be pretty pleased. Yes, well, that is still on sale. It's on tablet, of course, as well. Don't forget to download a free audiobook from audible.co.uk/wired. You will enjoy it. We will smile. Everyone will be happy. The world will be a better place. Kittens will sing. We'll all dance under rainbows. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
Oh, an old iPad.
It's not that old, guys.
How old?
Like, a year and a half, 2 years.
That's like granddad. It needs his dentures. Oh. Take it round the back of the shed and shoot it with both barrels.
It might even be a year old.